tonight. I do have a suggestion for the talk. And it's very apt because there's a few kids in front here, and in the middle I can see quite a few, because the talk tonight, somebody asked me to give a talk on the Buddhist attitude to helping children overcome their problems. Now, in case you're like me and haven't got any kids, you don't need to leave, because some of the things I will say will obviously affect each one of us, because it might be helping our friends, helping our partner in life, even helping our parents, because the same attitudes also apply to children. But especially some people who have a family, I want to know exactly how can Buddhism help overcome the problems in your children. And of course, it's not just overcoming your children's problems, it's overcoming your problems with children, which is more to the point. And sometimes people would ask, you know, how can a monk talk about these things? But it's just like a doctor does not need to have cancer to become an expert on cancer. You don't need to sort of have to experience all these things to actually know what's going on, because in Buddhism, as a meditator, you know how your mind works. You know what a person is. You know how they work. You know what a child is and how they think. And when you get into the mind of a child, you know exactly how they feel and what they need to be able to grow. In Buddhism, we look upon the child as like the seed, and you as the gardener, you the parent. We have to cultivate that seed to allow it to grow into a good tree, into a big tree. But as you know, the first thing of a gardener, that sometimes there's only so much you can do with the seed. Because the child comes into your life with its karma from the past. There's only so much you can do with that. Even the best gardeners, if they have a bad seed, can't do much. They can help a lot, but they can't make that tree into a beautiful tree. Maybe it'd be good enough. The same with a gardener who's a poor gardener. If you've got a good seed, that seed still grows into a wonderful person. The simile which I give is again from my own life, because my father's father, my paternal grandfather, was a terrible man, according to what my father said. My father was born in Liverpool. My paternal grandfather was a plumber in the time of the Depression in Europe. At that particular time, that no work was very hard. And so my paternal grandfather, if he did have a job, afterwards would go to the pub, spend the money on beer, come home drunk, instead of looking after the family, and immediately take off his belt to sort of beat any child who happened to be there before turning on his wife and then beating her. And of course, this is what we call today quite severe physical abuse. You know, both domestic abuse of a man to his wife and also domestic abuse of the father to the children. However, my father was the most kindest man you could ever imagine. He would never discipline us. It was my mother who did the disciplining. Simply because he told me once that when he was being beaten, he almost made a resolution, if ever I grow up and survive and have children myself, I won't do that. Having seen the pain that caused, the fear, just the terror of a little boy being whipped by a big man, he thought, no. That's wrong. I will never do that. And so my father never revisited that violence which he experienced as a child on myself and my brother. It was an example of how we don't always have to imitate or react the abuse which has been served on us. We don't need to be the victim and take that abuse and give it to someone else. There is another way. But I use that as an example of, you know, a man, my father, who obviously had a very good seed, and even though his parents, his father, was a very, very poor gardener, still my father happened to grow into a very big tree, a good tree. As parents, with our children, we just have to look after them, nurture them, care for them as much as we can. But we have our limits. And one of the first things to remember with nurturing children is to recognize those limits. Not every son can become a rocket scientist. Not every son could even do better than that and become a Buddhist monk. Well, that's the top, isn't it? Come on. So not every daughter will be just what you want it to be. So your job as a parent is actually not putting those restraints, that burden, that pressure on children, because that's one place where huge problems arise. A gardener looks after that tree for many years until it's strong enough to live by itself. And at that point, that's when the gardener lets go and goes home, or goes and looks after another tree. The trouble with many parents is they never let go of their children. They always want to dominate them, tell them what to do. They're always worrying about them. In Buddhism, we advise to look at how the birds look after their children, little babies. Sometimes the mother sits on that egg for hours at a time. If you've got a sore bottom sitting on your cushion, that's nothing compared to these hard, uncomfortable eggs. And they're willing to do that. And they go searching for worms or whatever else they eat all day, feeding their young. Then they teach them to fly. When I did my 6 month retreat, it was very beautiful. There was a pair of eagles not far away. I saw the eagles, they had two young. I used to watch them, sort of teaching their young how to fly. And just watching them, and just, you know, the two big ones followed by the two small ones. Very wonderful to see. But as soon as those birds can fly, what does mum and dad do? They go off and enjoy themselves and leave the kids. Okay, I've taught you enough now. Now you look after yourselves. Go on, get out of it. Wouldn't that be wonderful if you could do that? Instead of worrying about your kids, they're 20, they're 30, they're 40, and you still worry about them. So you're 20, you're old enough now, go, get out, look after yourself. Now you can see one of the problems is our attachment. We don't actually liberate our children. One of the great things about having children is looking after them and then freeing them. It takes one of these amazing things which help children overcome their problems by giving them trust at an early age. Because a child has to learn their independence. They have to learn to trust. You have to learn to trust them, to give them that freedom, to actually to explore the world in their own ways. Not the ways their parents would have them explore the world. But they have to experiment themselves. The child tree is not the same as the parent tree. They can't do things like you did. It's a good job they didn't, because you were pretty naughty when you were young. Sometimes I remember going to visit my brother. He's got two children, a boy and a girl. And I started telling my niece and nephew of all the naughty things my brother used to do. And my brother said, "Be quiet, shut up." Of course, the niece and nephew laughed. Oh, he did that, did he? Never told us that. Because the point was that my brother was, in a sense, being dishonest there. Not acknowledging his own faults when he was trying to teach the children to be good. Giving that freedom, that honesty, is very, very important to a child. They have to grow. And you don't grow if you're overly protected. You've got to take the seedling out of the pot, to actually to grow it in the natural earth, to allow it to be blown around by the wind, somehow, sometimes to be starved of moisture, sometimes to be flooded, to get that strength of real life. Overly protecting your children sometimes creates the problems. Of course, you know that bringing up a child is learning about life. I remember my parents arguing. They would have arguments, but I also remembered that after the argument, sometimes it would last all day. But I also remembered when they would make up, when they'd hug, say sorry and kiss, in front of me and my brother. The most important thing, they did it in front of us, so we could actually see. Yes, they had an argument. Yes, they make up. What I learned from that as a child, I remember now, what I learned was arguments happen. They're part of life. I never expected that two people, a man and a woman, could live together day after day after day without having disagreements. But I also learned how such conflict could be resolved in a very beautiful way. What that taught me was, yeah, even as a monk you'll have conflicts. Whatever you do in the world, there'll always be people arguing with you. And sometimes you can have an argument, sometimes you can shout at somebody, but at the end, well actually in the monastery we don't kiss and make up, but we do make up. What do you mean? We have this wonderful way of resolving the conflict. And see, what I mean here is that you're teaching children about real life. Overly protecting them is almost in a fantasy world, in a greenhouse where it's protected from all of the diseases, all of the unpleasantness. It will never work. You have to be creating the problems for your child because they've been overly protected, not seeing real life. So as a parent, as a person looking after a single parent, looking after the child, it's okay to argue, but it's important to make up. You know, in this world there is many, many conflicts, and you experience conflicts. The point with conflicts, we can't avoid conflicts, but we can learn how to resolve those conflicts in a wonderful way. And I always would pray, it didn't matter if it was my mother or my father, whoever made up first, it didn't matter who was right and who was wrong, the one who asked sorry first, who made the first move, even as a kid I respected them the most. It's what I tell in my monastery, if it ever is an argument, it does not matter who's right or who's wrong. The wise person, the one who's more advanced on the spiritual path, is the one who goes up to the other and says sorry for the first time. Because whenever you have an argument, you're both in denial. You both think it's his fault, it's her fault, she shouldn't have done that, he shouldn't have said that. Don't ever think like that, that it's somebody else's fault. If you think like that, you'll be waiting for them to make the first move, and the conflict never ends. It's have to be up to you. You be the one who says sorry first. I've done that many, many times in my life, and I'm always proud of that, those times. For those of you who've been here long enough to know my predecessor, Ajahn Chakra, I once had this really big argument with him for about a week. It's about our main hall. Up in 7-8. And those of you who go next week for Akatina, you'll see that big hall there. I wanted to build a different type of hall. He wanted to build it that way. And I had all of my reasons. I worked it all out. That was an expensive way of doing it. That wouldn't work. Look, I said, one day would be so big you would hardly be able to squash everybody in there. You see, I'm right. If you go next week, you can't squash anybody in there. I was right. But I was also wrong, because I was creating conflict. And this is one thing I'm proud of, and I don't mind praising this, because I was stupid for 1 week, but I was wise for about 30 minutes, which counted. Because I thought, what am I doing this for? What is a monastery anyway? Is a monastery the buildings? Is that what makes a monastery? You could have these beautiful buildings, like sometimes those of you who have gone to see these flash monasteries over in Asia. There was lovely marble here, beautiful, inspiring things, but no monks live in it. What's the point of having a beautiful monastery where there's no people actually living there? People actually like our monastery in Serpentine. They like going up to Gijigana, to the nuns' monastery, Dhammasara. Why? Because there's harmony and peace there. That's what makes a monastery, the people, not the buildings. What makes a family? Is it your mansion, or is it the people who live in it? What's most important is the people, not the things. So I had this great inspiration. I went up to Ajahn Chakra. I bowed 3 times. It's great bowing. That's why we bow here. You know, those of you who have never been here before, you wonder what the people do, all this bowing and scraping. It's a great act of humility. Letting go of your ego. It's not Asian. Even if the queen comes here, you'd actually bow or curtsy. This you used to do anyway. It's just an act of respect. But you're not respecting the monk, you're not respecting the piece of metal, you're respecting what it stands for. If you're respecting a Buddha statue, you're bowing down. When I bow down to a Buddha statue, I'm going off the point here, but when I bow to a Buddha statue, I bow to purity, compassion and peace. Those are things which are very important for me, like purity of conduct. Now, compassion, kindness is a wonderful thing. I worship compassion. I worship peace, the serenity of meditation. So when I bow down, I'm saying I worship you. I hold this higher than me. I aspire to those things. You can never get more compassion, more purity, more peace. So when I bow, that's what I do. I bow to those three qualities. And in the psychological effect of bowing down, worshipping, something like that, I find that I start to imitate those things more and more. Whatever you worship, you start to imitate. I noticed that 4 or 5 years ago, there was a World Cup soccer, and many young men were worshipping David Beckham. No, not David Beckham, Ronaldo, I think his name was, who had this really strange haircut. And I saw, because they worshipped him, they started imitating him. They also had the same haircut. When I was a young man, I used to worship Jimi Hendrix. And that's what I look like, believe it or not. Whenever we worship, if you worship the Buddha, if you worship them enough, that's what you begin to look like. And that's actually why, you know, you have a monk or a nun here. You're not worshipping the person, you're worshipping what they stand for. That's what happened to me, because when I was first went to Thailand and became a monk, because I was sort of a young man in the 60s or 70s, equality, you know, really left wing. You know, actually, I used to go on these demonstrations in Cambridge shouting, "Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh," down the streets. Didn't know what it meant, but, you know, it's cool. It's what you did at that time as a young man, with your beard and your beads. And, what was I going to say? I've forgotten now, anyway. That's what you said. Oh, my God, I've completely forgotten now. Anyway, that's what you used to do at the time when you were very, very young. But, you know, that's what you used to imitate. What you used to worship, that's actually what you used to become. Now, if you actually... That's right. When I became a monk in Thailand, people started worshipping me. They started bowing down 3 times. Now, it'd be the same with you. If someone did that to you for the first time, you'd feel very uncomfortable. So that's what I did. I told the people bowing down, I said, "Look, you do that to the Thai monks, but I'm English. Don't do it to me, please." Now what they said next was actually really hit me very hard. They said, "Look, we're not bowing down to you. We're bowing down to what you represent." And I found out I suddenly became very disappointed. Actually, I was proud, I was eager. It was nice to have someone bow down to you. It was just, you know, my theory sort of got in the way and thought I shouldn't have that, but it was nice. But that's not what you do these days. You bow down to what it represents. Okay, so this is actually why we do this bowing business. It's psychology. But actually, going back to sort of like to children, is actually we're trying actually to have children, or get our children, actually to have children, I'm not supposed to having children as a monk, we're trying to actually to get children to become sort of better people, and to encourage them to learn. And obviously by our example, if they really respect us, and we are a good example, then of course by worshipping us, they will try to imitate us. And of course that many children obviously do worship their parents. They take them as their examples. And so if you're a person who hasn't got problems, then it's very likely, or that you show the way out of problems, it's very likely that you will encourage your children also not to have problems. You'll be showing them by example. Children are very smart. They may not listen to what you say, but they certainly listen to what you do. They hear and they watch. Young children imitate you. When they get older, they rebel against you, but they still listen. One of the things which I know, no matter what you think the children are hearing. Sometimes you think they're deaf to your advice. But they do listen. They listen and they think about what's being said. And if it makes sense to them, and if they, you are a person of respect, they will follow. I remember once my father telling me that he said, "Son, if ever you want something that bad, you're willing to steal it. If ever you want it that bad, you're considering stealing it from some shop or something. Don't steal it. Come and ask me and I'll get it for you, no matter what it is." And that really hit me very hard, because my father was a very poor man. You know, for most of his life he was sick, couldn't really hold down a job because of his illnesses, he had bad asthma. But he was willing to sacrifice if I really needed something. He said, "Don't steal." What he taught me there was actually, he was more willing to sacrifice than have me steal. It told me about what stealing really meant to him. And from that time on, there's no way I would steal. No, not that I would ask him for these things, I knew I couldn't afford it, but it really, I found out from that saying just what my father thought about stealing and how bad it was. My father would rather sacrifice so much than have his son steal anything. That was actually why I could overcome those urges as a kid, you know, to take things. He was also the one who, that when I was only 11 years of age, and I got a place in the school soccer team. And of course, we were very proud to play on the school soccer team. And I was even more proud when my father turned up to watch on a Saturday morning, especially when I knew he should have been working. He's supposed to be working on a Saturday morning. He had a job in a service station, a petrol station, in a garage. And I asked him afterwards, "How'd you do that? I thought you were working, Dad." And he told me he actually lied to see his son play soccer. Because he was ill, he told his boss, he told me, that his doctor had ordered a series of injections every Saturday morning for the next 7 weeks. The whole of the season. So my father actually, not only lied, I'm not sort of encouraging lying, but what I'm saying there is that my father was actually risking his job, going to such degree of sacrifice to see his son play soccer. What does that do? What that did was, my goodness, it wasn't just sort of giving up a little bit. He gave up a lot, because he knew how much it meant to a little son. Now when you have a model like that, someone you can really look up to, someone you really respect, someone you really worship, of course, then what that person says, you really listen to. You take it on board. And of course, if you have that moral authority, then what is said does have enormous weight. So always remember that story of Mahatma Gandhi. When he was a young man living in London, just studying law, in his little rooms with a landlady, his landlady came up to him one day and said, "Mr. Gandhi, my son does not listen to me, but for some reason he listens to you. My son is taking too much sugar. Can you please take him aside and tell him not to take so much?" And Mr. Gandhi, not famous yet, this was in his biography, said, "Certainly, madam, I will tell your son about his sugar habit." The days passed, turned into weeks, the son was still taking as much sugar as before. So the landlady came to see Mr. Gandhi again and said, "Mr. Gandhi, do you remember what I said a couple of weeks ago about my son's sugar habit? You said you were going to talk to him about it, but you haven't. Why?" And Mr. Gandhi replied, "Madam, I have told your son not to take so much sugar, but only this morning." "Why did you wait so long?" said the landlady. "Because it was only yesterday that I gave up taking sugar," said Mr. Gandhi. Now, I said that story here before, but it's very important. How can you train children if you're telling them to do what you don't do? or you tell them not to do what you do. When I was a school teacher, there was a rule in the school that no children were allowed to smoke cigarettes. And the children complained to me. They said, every time we go to the staff room and someone opens the door, this whole cloud of cigarette smoke comes out. Of course, a bunch of hypocrites. And fair enough, fair comment. So in order to allow those children to overcome those problems, if we want to have some authority to really lead and to help, if we really want to be a good gardener, we have to show it by our actions. So one of the great ways of helping children overcome their problems, overcome your problems, first of all, become a compassionate, wise, selfless, pure-hearted, pure-speaking person. I say pure-speaking because, you know, these words, can they hurt very much, and sometimes unskillful parents can create huge problems by the way they speak to their kids. Years ago, I was coming here, I think gave a talk at a school somewhere. I think it was the old Scarborough Beach High School, years ago. It's now been removed. And I had one of these tickets on the buses. Get on the bus. And having gone to this school, I was coming back here to give the Friday night talk. And on the back of the bus, I was sat behind two school kids. And I was listening to their conversation. And it reminded me of my days at school. Reminded me just of the conversation which happened in the schoolyard and on the way to school, on the way home. Kids always cutting each other to pieces with their mouths, always criticizing. If you listen to the way that some kids speak to each other, it's always critical, putting them down. If it's girls, yeah, you're not pretty, you've got a big nose, but look at you, you're just fat. Whatever it is. A lot of times, the only time that people speak to each other is to criticize. And I remember what it was like being a kid at school, getting criticized by your friends. And you go into class, and unless you're top of the class, you get criticized by your teachers for not trying hard enough, even though you're trying your best. And you go home, and you get criticized by your parents. Imagine what that happens to you. If you have that day in, day out, year in, year out, no wonder some children have the problems of surliness, uncooperative, even sometimes rebellious to the point of even being suicidal. Why? Listen to what they hear. Wouldn't that be the same with you? A young child needs encouragement much more than criticism. It's the peer pressure growing up. The girls want to be most attractive, more pretty. The boys want to be stronger, tougher, whatever it is. Growing up together, this incredible competition, which causes a criticism. This competition business, I've said this before, it's one of the worst things about our society, how competitive we are. And this is one of the reasons why I think that in schools, one of the great ways of overcoming the problems of kids in schools is having not just competition, but cooperation. I want to have these schools have a system of examinations or marks at the end of the year. In one class, they have 30 kids, maybe 60-70% will be your personal score. The rest will be averaged over the whole class. So you'll be marked by how well the class works together. The bright kids helping the weak kids in every subject. And they will be rewarded for how well they cooperate. Because what happens in real life? When you're married a family, you have to cooperate. It's not just competition, who's the best. Sometimes it's like that in a family, isn't it? Competition. Who can speak the sharpest words and get their own way. Sometimes in an office, you know, who can get the promotion. That's bad for business. You have to cooperate. In religion, far too much competition. Not enough cooperation. Isn't that one of the great weaknesses of our society? We're always trying to sort of beat each other instead of trying to work together. So we have to... One of the problems with children is a competitive growing up. We're not encouraging the cooperation between people. And one of the ways to emphasize cooperation is with encouragement rather than always fault-finding and criticizing. Which is why when you have a kid, you want to overcome the problems. Praise, praise, praise. Encourage, encourage, encourage. Not just always finding fault with what they're not doing, but praising them for what they are doing. Imagine if you were a kid and you got that type of praise. You'd want to go to school. You'd want to listen to your parents. You'd want to do the homework or whatever it is if you can get praise for it. You're always getting criticized. You're not working hard enough. You're going out too long. You know, your hair's too long, so you're too sloppy, you're just not respectful to your parents, you're not doing your chores, your bedroom's a mess. You can always sort of say something positive. As, you know, saying, well, you know, so your bedroom's, you know, it's it's not as untidy as sort of, you know, that sort of place where the bomb went off in sort of Jakarta. Whatever, so be inventive, you can always say something positive. But what it's saying here is that, you know, you're actually encouraging people and encouraging children. I know I go on about this again and again, probably every week, about praise is much more important than sort of blame. If you're in a relationship with another person and you criticize them, that relationship is going to end. Praise them. It's easy to do. It's fun to do. You get much more traction in your relationship from a bit of praise. It goes a long way. Everybody loves it. It's free. It's got no bad side effects. It makes you feel good. It makes her feel good or him feel good. It makes the kids feel good. They work harder as a result. This is what happened to me when I got praised by my father just for, you know, trying my best. I tried harder. It's what you do when you get praise. You want to work harder for this. And so you get more positive energy. So that praising your kids goes a long, long way. If you do have to find fault with them, count the number of times you criticize them and find fault with them. You tell them off for something. Count those times every day. Have a notebook and tally them. And make sure, at least, minimum, every word of criticism is matched with one word of praise. Or one sentence of praise, one phrase of praise, at least. So the kid feels that they're respected, that they're acknowledged, that they are loved. Sometimes people think, of course I love my kids, but do you actually show it with your words? And that way you're encouraging children to grow up when it's just such a difficult period, especially in their puberty years. So much competition. So much striving to, you know, to succeed, to, you know, be successful in the mating game. Let alone being successful at school as well, when it's supposed to be so important. So that way that we can actually praise and encourage our kids. It doesn't matter sort of what they do. Encourage them and praise them. They don't always have to become top of the class. They can't always become top of the class. No one can always become top of the class. And this is, those of you who read that little book of mine, Open the Door of Your Heart, one of the true stories in that book. When I was a school teacher, this is how I praised my kids in the class. At the end of the year, one child in my class came bottom of the class. Of course, they have to. Someone has to come bottom. But that kid, I saw them when he gave out the report cards. You know, as they did in school, you get your report card, they look at it, ugh, bottom. How am I going to show this to my mum and dad? And you saw them there looking really depressed and glum, almost suicidal. Well, that's not suicidal, but they're probably thinking about something like that. And I decided it's time to act, to help children overcome their problems. So I went up to them and I looked at them in the eye and smiled and said, what you've done is a wonderful thing. In Buddhism, because I knew I was a Buddhist, as a school teacher I was a Buddhist, I said, what you've done is like what in Buddhism we call, like, you're a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva is someone who sacrifices their own happiness for the sake of others. He said, you have been far more compassionate than these other sort of people in the class, because you've taken this terrible position. It's so hard to become bottom of the class. And it's just so unpleasant and difficult and troublesome. But you, out of your great compassionate heart, have taken this awful position so that no one else has to suffer the ignominy of becoming bottom. In fact, you know, of all the people in this class, you're probably the kindest, you know, the most spiritual inside. You know, really, I think you should get the medal. And he looked at me, like many of you looking at me, thinking I'm crazy. But it worked. Because he laughed. And that laughter sort of just broke that sort of depression and sadness. Because he realised, though, it's only just, you come bottom once, somebody does that once, you think, oh, I'm so compassionate because I took that position. Next year, he didn't come bottom. Someone else took that position. It was encouraging them. And sort of, instead of like feeling just so down upon yourself, because life sometimes does make you bottom of the class. So what? Big deal. These days I tell people about one of my favourite monks. That monk came bottom of the class 3 years in a row in grade one. In Thailand. After 1 year in grade one in Thailand, the teacher just could not pass him. Had to redo grade one. I don't know what he couldn't do, plasticine or drawing stickman or something. But he couldn't pass, so he had to repeat it. After 2 years, just, you know, primary school teachers are very compassionate. It's only going up to grade two, but no, he has to do it third year. After 3 years of grade one, she couldn't sort of promote him. So after 3 years, that was it, he had to leave school. Not even finishing grade one, it's a true story. Now, what happens to people who are that sort of, you know, stupid? They send them to a monastery to become monks. But not all monks begin life that way. So they went to this monastery. And of course, you know, some of these, the abbots, are just so compassionate and kind. And they accepted this, you know, this basically village idiot. And tried so hard to teach him some basic Buddhism, like Four Noble Truths. How many was that again? That Eightfold Path, what does that mean? And trying to teach him some chanting, but you know, just nothing would stick. He just couldn't do it. And the poor old abbot got frustrated after a year or two. So the last resort, this was in Thailand, the last resort, if even in the village monastery it doesn't work, they send him to the meditation monastery. It's the last resort. And just the monk there, the teacher said, okay, just present moment awareness, silence, just watch your breath go in and go out. His mind was just so pure and simple. It was just so easy to do. He soon got into the deepest of meditations, became a saint. And actually, his chanting, he couldn't learn chanting in this life, but he got so deep in meditation, he remembered a past life. When his brain was much sharper, when he could learn his chanting from the past life. He actually used that to chant in this life. And that's how he could do all the chanting. He became a very famous saint in Thailand. So any of you who have children who can't pass grade one, send them to me. We could have this great saint with great psychic powers and great meditation. The point is there, that's an extreme example that every child is valued. Every child is worthwhile. No matter what they do in school, that's not important. It's sort of important, you encourage them, but that's not absolutely necessary. When a child feels valued, not rejected, half of their problems disappear, if not more. It's rejection. Is the main cause of problems in a child. They're growing up and already they feel very alone. The mother might say, I really love you. The father might say, you're my son, I love you, but they don't show it. They want them to be something different than they are. In Buddhism we start how a person is, accepting that. And that is the start of growth, acceptance, kindness, compassion, love. If we start where we think they should be, then that's fighting, battles, wars. That's actually, if you look at it very deeply, that's hatred. It's not real love. It's control. It never works. So look at our children as they are. Accept you as you are, child. Whatever you do in your life, the door of my heart will always be open to you as you are. You don't have to succeed. You don't have to pass your exams. You don't have to tidy your room. I will love you, son, daughter, for who you are. Always. No strings attached. If you could really do that, your son or daughter would go and tidy their room, do well at school, whatever you want, because they want to live up to what you ask of them. This is actually how a child grows without those problems. You're encouraging them rather than controlling them. You're nurturing them. If you have a tree or a plant in your garden, you fast feed it, you know, with sort of super fertilizer. Sure, it might grow quickly, but it's not a good flower. It just falls over. It's not coming its natural way. As a parent looking after you, you've got to allow them to grow naturally. And spending time with them, know you really care about them. And in that caring, nurturing, that's accepting them for who they are. That's where the growth comes. That's where the praise comes. That's where many of the problems come. And if we invest that in our kids, they become great adults. Adults who are both happy inside and who can actually help others. That's the main purpose of life. I was asked this at some interview only recently. He said, why did you become a monk? I said, because even as a young boy, I felt life has two main purposes. And this is what I want you to do in my life. Number one, for your own fulfillment, your own happiness, whatever you do in life, so you feel happy. Number two, so you can serve others and give happiness to other people. Someone asked me what the meaning of life is. I said, that's that twofold happiness. To give happiness to others and to create happiness for yourself. The meaning, the quest for life. If you're on one side, you've got happiness, but you don't give to others, it doesn't work. If you give to others, but you're so dry inside, it doesn't work. It has to be both. That's how we can teach our children. I want you to be happy, so you can give happiness to others. How you do that, whether it's just a bus driver, street sweeper, or whatever, that's up to you. That's my goal for you, and I'm here to help you reach that goal. To do that, you have to trust the child, to trust them to almost like manifest their own destiny in this world, to respect their own abilities and what they have to give in this world. I live in a forest down at Serpentine. Many of the trees in those forests are dead trees. When I first went to Serpentine, I wanted to knock down those dead trees, to actually saw them off. I thought they spoiled the forest, having all these dead, you know, dieback jarrah trees up there. Until somebody stopped me. They said, Ajahn Brahm, don't cut those trees down, because in those trees, that's where the birds nest. That's where the possums in the hollows of the tree, that's where they nest. There's so many beings in this forest rely upon those dead trees. Leave them alone. And I changed my attitude. I started to value the dead trees in the forest. They were important. When you're wise, everything is valued, because everything has its place in a forest. They don't all have to be beautiful, straight, big trees with this luxuriant foliage. Even the small trees and the bushes are important. Your children don't have to be these big, great people, you know, who are great doctors serving the world. Sure, a forest should have those beings, but they also, those big beings, also need the old dead trees, the small little bushes, the crooked saplings. They too are just as important in the forest. In the same way that your child, doesn't matter what they do in this life. I remember one parent, they told me they're very happy that their son, who'd been on the dole for many years, they said he had a job working in the office. They're so pleased until they found out that what the office meant was a dole office. He'd just roll up every week to pick up his money.
He called that an office job.
But still, he had his place in the world, whatever that place was. And those people are important also. Everyone has a place in the world, and so we value them for who they are. I know some people come and ask me, said, I've got a child, should we bring them up as a Buddhist? I say, no. Do not bring your child up as a Buddhist, otherwise you just become another evangelist. So the last thing you should do is bring your child up as a Buddhist. What you should do, which actually comes from this monk, who's now actually in the United States, Ajahn Amaro, he said this, brilliant advice. He said, if you've got a child, bring them up to value two qualities and to cultivate them until those qualities are very strong inside of them. Bring them up to be honest, number one. To be honest to themselves, to be honest to the world, so they're not deceivers of themselves or deceivers of others. To be honest, number one. And number two, encourage and teach them to question. Question as much as you like. And be honest enough, if you don't know the answer, to admit you don't know. To be honest enough, when you find the answer, yeah, that feels right. Because he said, what you're doing there, you're equipping your child to find their own religion, their own path in this world. And if Buddhism is worthwhile, if it's a good religion, those two tools of honesty and questioning will allow them to reach that goal by themselves. Which is what is important for a child. Not that you give them that religion, but they earn it for themselves. You can't give your child truth, no more than your parents could give you truth. You have to find it yourself. And this was a beautiful advice on how you can bring up children to encourage not know where they will end up, but how to get there. The tools of life. And of course, all I've said so far about praising, encouraging, nurturing, you know, questioning and being honest, accepting for who you are. Doesn't matter if you're an old dead tree or if you're a young sapling or crooked or whatever. That degree of acceptance you find is just this beautiful means for loving others and loving yourself. Accepting others, accepting yourself, accepting this world with its arguments, but being able to reconcile. This beautiful wide heart which can accept all beings and all things as they are. Sometimes I did some stupid things, but my parents would accept that. So that's your learning. They don't approve of it, but they know that I had to go that way. I still feel so sorry about my poor mother. When I was only 17, my father had just died. And I remember her standing on the balcony, waving, as I took my guitar and I didn't have a rucksack, I just had a sleeping bag. I went off hitchhiking to North Africa. I must have driven her crazy. But she let me go. And I learned so much. That was my first excursion on my own, learning just how to survive. Of course, there was some danger there, but it's all just risk analysis, risk taking. You have to take risks. But I learned so much. And I love my mother so much more for allowing me to go. If she hadn't, I would have gone anyway. But of course you would, but not with the same feeling of sort of acceptance and kindness. Many kids have problems in this world because there's sometimes that we don't know really what love is and what acceptance is, what wisdom is and how to bring up our children. Look at what you've heard today. Many of you have been paying attention, and I'm just a monk who never had children. Perhaps I did have children because I'm a preceptor. I ordain monks, even nuns as well. I call them my babies. And there's those babies in my monastery, those of you who come to feed them every day or every week, and see them grow. You see just how I nurture those as if I was a parent, give them much freedom, allowing them to make mistakes, praising and encouraging them, but very rarely criticizing them. Because that's how my teacher, Ajahn Chah, almost like my spiritual father, would nurture me. Sometimes when I did stupid things, you go up to him expecting to be punished. That's how I thought, you know, when you do something wrong, you should be punished. When I did something wrong and told him, he would almost fall off his chair laughing. He used to think, you know, all my mistakes were so funny. And that I laughed at myself as well. Instead of actually thinking that he'd done something terribly, terribly wrong, it was just the joke. The joke of life. Silly people making mistakes. I was learning, and it's just an encouraging thing to say, okay, go away, try again. But no sort of holding you back. Encouraging to see, you know, how you can manifest what's inside of you. And accepting you for who you are. Growing, nurturing. Maybe that way our children won't have so many problems. We can actually bring up our kids to be cooperative, loving, caring, wise, at peace with their role in the world, but still with the ability to reach their potential, to serve for their own happiness and for the happiness of the whole world. So that's the little talk this evening on helping children overcome their problems and also helping you overcome yours. Thank you. Okay, any questions or comments? Now, what did I say that you're supposed to teach your children two things? One's honesty and the other one is questioning. Obviously, I'm not a very good parent because... Yeah, thank you. Where they go, okay. Wait one evening when they go out to night clubbing or something and then lock the door. No, sometimes you have to be firm. If they won't go, put up the rent. Stop feeding them. That's a hard thing. The reason why they don't go, when it comes down to it, is because the parents don't want them to go. And you, many, many ways, you work hard to make sure they don't go. They get a nice girlfriend, you go rubbishing them. I mean, this is a terrible girl for you. I wouldn't go out with her anymore. Rah, rah, rah. Whatever verse is. So sometimes they need to be encouraged. Because it's important that sort of, you know, that the tree, or the sort of the seed, the mango, it actually leaves the tree to actually to grow by itself. To go out into the world. Like sometimes the birds actually do kick their young out of the nest. Look at the kangaroos. The kangaroos in our monastery now, they've got the joeys inside. And the little joey heads are poking out. They're just the cutest thing. I've seen this for 21 years now, that monastery. I still get lots of joy seeing these little joeys sort of diving back into the mother's pouch, all legs and tail all over the place. And then just going around inside and poking their head out afterwards. But the joeys from last year are now being chased away by their mothers. They've got a new joey now. And the child from last year now has to fend for themselves. And sometimes the mother has to whack them with a paw around the head. I've seen it many times. They go whack. Now, I'm not encouraging that because you get sued, or I'll get sued for that. But kangaroos don't have lawyers, so it's okay. But you can see the idea there. It's just, you know, sometimes, you know, just give them a bit of a shove. Any other question there? Thank you. Yeah, go. Yeah. Again, the biggest malevolence, the biggest evil, if you like, is stupidity, ignorance. And again, I mean, that's actually overcome, again, by questioning and honesty. And if kids, not just kids, if all people were really asked to question, and, you know, to take honesty is really, really important. To actually to be able to think for themselves and to challenge others. Now, you know just how often that there's this spin on the media, this spin on sort of by governments, this spins on even religions, always getting you to believe, you know, what I say is true. And that's the danger there. I mean, there's just people don't think for themselves. There's this little saying which I heard recently, when everybody thinks the same, no one thinks at all. And the last thing I want in this place here is when everybody thinks the same. Do you agree with me? So all together say, yeah. So when you question, that malevolence very often just disappears. Cause it's the malevolence of like, you know, stupid thinking. It's very easy, you know, for someone in my position, because you know, in front of many people, actually, to incite anger and hatred, because it makes you feel good. And you can really get people going, really get the anger going, if you really wanted to. It's very easy, but when people question, say, no, that's wrong, that feels wrong, that is wrong, you question, and you're honest to that. Then those rabble-rousers, the real malevolent people never hurt other people, they get other people to hurt in their place. That's the real malevolent people. They don't do the dirty work themselves. They use others. And that's where there's others, you know, have to question. Just they're weak and easily led. Why? Because they haven't been trained in questioning and honesty. It's one of the great things I liked about Buddhism when I was first here. You can ask any question you like. You can disagree. You know, you have many times with me, Lawrence, and I respect you for that. Anyone who keeps on sort of being a psychopath saying, yeah, everything you say is just absolutely perfect truth, and then you get very, very worried. Question, question, question. And I think the whole world needs actually to do more questioning and be more honest. Not to believe too easily without really solid grounds. That's the evil in the world. Does that make sense? Okay, the other evil in the world is going over time, because you have to go back, I have to go back, and our president here is with the microphone, so thank you for listening today. Now, we have the announcement.